readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and today, less will be more. I've done my research, checked lists from around the literary landscape, including Goodreads, Powell City of Books, and The Guardian, to come up with fabulous short story collections. Perhaps like me, short stories aren't your first go-to genre. In fact, one critic likened them to orphans. Even when a story gets published in a major periodical, they can remain largely unread. Today, we'll preview some stellar examples of tales that differ wildly. My guest, Russell Banks, is the author of several distinguished novels, but we'll be discussing his new short story collection and the challenges of reeling in readers in a very few pages. It's all ahead as we turn to page one of the Book Report. We begin today's show with a collection from one of the genre's most monumental voices, Nobel Prize winner Alice Munro. Dear Life encompasses moments of change, chance encounters, and twists of fate that create a new way of thinking or being. Munro's stories form a radiant portrait of just how dangerous and strangely ordinary life can be. Liza Ross and Robert Slade narrate.
His opinions were something like his complexion. When they went to see a movie, he never wanted to talk about it afterwards. He would say that it was good, or pretty good, or okay. He didn't see the point in going further. He watched television. He read a book in somewhat the same way. He had patience with such things. The people who put them together were probably doing the best they could. Greta used to argue, rashly asking whether he would say the same thing about a bridge. The people who did it did their best, but their best was not good enough, so it fell down. Instead of arguing, he just laughed. It was not the same thing, he said. No. No. Greta should have realized that this attitude, hands off, tolerant, was a blessing for her because she was a poet, and there were things in her poems that were in no way cheerful or easy to explain. Peter's mother and the people he worked with, those who knew about it, still said poetess. She had trained him not to. Otherwise, no training necessary. The relatives she had left behind in her life and the people she knew now in her role as a housewife and mother did not have to be trained because they knew nothing about this peculiarity. It would become hard to explain, later on in her life, just what was okay in that time and what was not. You might say, well, feminism was not. But then you would have to explain that feminism was not even a word people used. Then you would get all tied up saying that having any serious idea, let alone ambition, or maybe even reading a real book, could be seen as suspect, having something to do with your child's getting pneumonia, and a political remark at an office party might have cost your husband his promotion. It would not have mattered which political party either. It was a woman's shooting off her mouth that did it. People would laugh and say, oh, surely you are joking. And you would have to say, well, but not that much. Then she would say, one thing, though, was that if you were writing poetry, it was somewhat safer to be a woman than a man. That was where the word poetess came in handy, like a web of spun sugar. Peter would not have felt that way, she said, but remember, he had been born in Europe. He would have understood, though, how the men he worked with were supposed to feel about such things. That summer, Peter was going to spend a month, or maybe longer, in charge of a job that was being done at Lund, far up, in fact, as far as you could go north, on the mainland. There was no accommodation for Katie and Greta. But Greta had kept in touch with a girl she used to work with in the Vancouver library, who was married now and living in Toronto. She and her husband were going to spend a month in Europe that summer. He was a teacher. and she had written Greta wondering if Greta and her family would do them a favor. She was very polite. By occupying the house in Toronto for part of that time, not letting it stand empty. And Greta had written back telling her about Peter's job, but taking up the offer for Katie and herself. That was why they were now waving and waving from the platform and from the train.
We've just heard Dear Life by Alice Munro. Russell Banks was born in Massachusetts and raised in New Hampshire. His father, a plumber, deserted the family when Russell was 12, and Russell helped provide for his mother and three siblings. An excellent student, he won a scholarship to Colgate, but he dropped out in his first year with the intention of joining Castro's insurgent army. He wound up working in a department store in Lakeland, Florida. He lived briefly in Boston, where he began to write short fiction and poetry. He then attended the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Throughout the 1960s, Banks contributed short stories to a variety of literary magazines. He graduated with honors and returned to New Hampshire, where he taught at the University of New Hampshire and at Emerson College in Boston. The 1971 volume of The Best American Short Stories included his fiction. One of his collection of short stories, Searching for Survivors, won an O. Henry Award. Banks ascended to the first rank of American novelists in 1985 with the publication of Continental Drift, a dual point of view work about an oil burner repairman from New Hampshire and a Haitian refugee. The convergence of lives and experiences around violence and tragedy permeates his novels. His most recent novel was 2011's The Lost Memory of Skin. Russell is retired from his position as the Howard G.B. Clark University Professor at Princeton. He lives in upstate New York and Miami. Today we'll chat with him about his new short story collection, A Permanent Member of the Family, his sixth collection of short stories and the first in almost 15 years. Welcome, Russell, and thanks for stopping by the Book Report.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
We spoke last time about Lost Memory of Skin.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. That which is a set in a, although it's not named Miami, it's obviously anyone who lives here knows that it's very much a Miami story.
Yeah. Right. We're going to talk today about A Permanent Member of the Family, which is a collection of short stories. I've wondered, how did you choose which stories to put in the collection?
Well, actually, I didn't choose from a range of stories. I sat down and wrote them one after the other until I had a book. Usually what I've done in the past is finish a novel, which usually for me takes 3 years, more or less, give or take a year, and then sit down and write a bunch of stories and then go back to writing novels, and then eventually I would go through the stories that I had written and pull together a dozen or so and make a collection out of them. In this case, I didn't. I had written three novels in a row, and I came off that last one, Lost Memory of Skin, in a state of fatigue and despair, and I said, I've got to sit down and write some stories for a while. And I went through my notebooks and clipping files, which I keep, and just pulled out the dozen or so that I thought were had story material in them. Then sometimes they were just a little sketch, a paragraph or two that I had written and then forgotten about. Sometimes it was a news clipping. Sometimes it was an article in a magazine or something that had caught my attention. I said, someday I'm going to write a story about that. Well, this was the day. And so I wrote one after the other over a course of a year. And then I realized, I said, this is not a bad book. I think I've got a book and I'm going to go ahead and let it go. And it turned out to be, yes, a permanent member of the family. And of course, as a result of their having been written together in relatively short space of time, they share certain things. They overlap a little bit thematically, and certain obsessions recur. And someone once noticed that, gee, you've got an awful lot of dogs in this book. There are dogs. I didn't realize it, but yeah, dogs keep walking into the room, and they're part of the characters, really. And in a couple of them, they're the main character. And to my surprise. guys. So they have that kind of that quality. I think they feel like they were all written very close to one another. And then the themes of family and the fragility of family and the necessity of family and how the two are often in conflict have to do, of course, with my own life. I mean, this is how I've lived long enough to have seen these dramas unfold, and from the child's point of view, from the adult's point of view, from the husbands, from the wives, from the mothers, from the fathers, etc. And so it was a chance to kind of deal with that material, those experiences, and make something out of them.
Well, one quick question. Do you have a dog?
Well, I actually, over the course of last year, I had two dogs, beloved dogs, border collies. And first one died, and then the second died. They were elderly dogs, so it wasn't a tragedy. But it was a sudden hole in my life, and I was very aware of that. And I know that's why the dogs ended up in the stories. I was sort of reincarnating them in a way in fictional form. They do become like members of your family. And these particular dogs were extremely close to my wife and myself.
As a reader of great, big, fat, juicy fiction novels, I'm always amazed at the skill that a short story writer has to get a reader to care about a character in such a few number of pages. How do you develop that skill?
Yeah, I'm not sure how one develops it, I think. For me, of course, I'm my first and, in a sense, my last reader, too. I'm writing for myself, and so I'm trying to engage my own imagination from the very beginning and my own emotions and thoughts as deeply and quickly and effectively as I can. When I write that first sentence down, which can be almost random, the next sentence has got to interest me. You know, it's got to catch my attention in a meaningful way. And so I think that's all that a writer does anyhow. And then you've got two sentences down, and you try to make a third sentence that'll keep you attentive and engaged and so forth. So, I mean, that's really where all skill, such as we call it, arises, and craft and so forth, I think. Also, you learn over the time that there are certain basic fundamental forms that will allow you to tell a story. And over time, you become not necessarily conscious of those. In fact, you're likely to become less conscious of those forms, but they plug in a sense, you know. And one of the things I love about short story writing is that when you begin it, anything is possible. You can begin a story anywhere. But every time you write a sentence, you narrow the options down. It's like a tree, you know, in reverse. You know, you're cutting branches down until you finally get down to just two. And the last couple of paragraphs in a short story are about choosing which of the two endings, you know, are you going to go with. And that's when the smoke starts to come out of one's ears and you're really bearing down. And you have to ask yourself really fundamental kind of questions and say, what do I really believe is true about the world here? Now, is it A or is it B? You're not asking yourself which is a better ending or which is a cuter ending or which ending will the reader like more. You're asking yourself, what do I believe in a very fundamental way? And that's what writing the story is trying to lead you towards, is what's trying to lead the reader towards.
We're speaking with Russell Banks on The Book Report. How often has it happened, or has it ever happened, that you sit down to write a short story and you're well into it and you say, this is turning into a novel. This is going to be my next novel.
It's only happened once.
Which book?
It was Rule of the Bone. And I wanted to write a short story about... I was working in a prison in upstate New York, and I kept coming in contact with these kids that were in their early 20s or so and were doing time, most of it for drugs. And I realized at a certain point they all had, from the age of 14 or so, lived outside normal family life. Either they had, you know, been kicked out of the house, or their parents had abandoned them, or they were living with a grandparent, or they were living with a sibling or something like that. But they weren't living in what we would think of as the nuclear family. And I I asked them all, how did they come to live on their own? I mean, just to write an answer to that question. And it turned out they came to live on their own through really stupid little mistakes in life. You know, like I hit a gym teacher, or, you know, or my mother had a guy move in and he didn't like me, or I didn't like him. And from that, he got kicked out of the house. And so that was the story. And then I finished and I said, now I wonder what's going to happen to this kid. He's out there on the streets, you know, and he's homeless. He's a 14-year-old homeless boy. And so I wrote the next, what became then chapter two in Rule of the Bone. And then, well, what really, I wonder what happened to him after that. And then chapter three and so on. And before I knew it, I had the novel.
In the title story, A Permanent Member of the Family, is it autobiographical, and will you share a bit of that story with listeners?
Yeah, I'll confess that that is. It, you know, it was after a divorce in the 70s, and I had three children, and we were experimenting with joint custody, which was a big deal then, and an experimental kind of arrangement. And I lived in the very close by, and so the kids would go back and forth and everything. And we had a family dog. And there was no way the dog would allow us to have joint custody. The dog is a pack animal, and the dog chose me to take care of her. And so she stayed with me. And in a way, it was great, because then the kids would come down, not to see me, they'd come down to see the family dog. And that became a big image in the family, an important one. And then I accidentally drove over the dog. She was very, very old, and she would sleep under the car. And then once that happened, of course, then that kind of broke a shell that was surrounding us during this divorce, because we were all pretending everything was going really well and everybody was happy with the divorce. But of course, everybody was miserable with the divorce. And once the dog, then it was Daddy killed the dog.
How do you get back from that?
I know, it was really hard. Well, you're trying to write a story about it many years later is what happened.
In researching for this interview, I read that as a college kid, you were considering joining Castro's Revolution. Uh-huh. What was the attraction and what happened?
Well, I wasn't even a college kid. I was a dropout. I was 18 years old in 1958, the winter of 58-59. And Castro had been presented in the American press then. You may not remember. You're much too young. For a young romantic boy like me who had love of the underdog in place of politics, it was and it was also a kind of had hit the road, more or less, in a Jack Kerouacian way. It was a big draw. And so, yeah, so that was how I first got to Miami from New England. I came down here on my way. I didn't know how to get over to Cuba, and I couldn't speak Spanish, but I figured that those were problems I could probably solve eventually on the ground. And then in February, they marched into Havana, and they no longer needed me. And this skinny white kid from New England.
You split your time between upstate New York and Miami. Do you find that you write differently in either location?
You know, I don't. I thought I would. We've been doing it for quite a few years, and I don't notice that. I think that maybe when I was younger, it would have had a bigger impact on me, but I carry both places with me in my mind and heart. When I'm here, I have immediate access to that world, and when I'm there, I have immediate access to this world.
Are you already at work on something new?
Yeah, I am, and I don't really understand it yet. I don't know much about it. I'm pretty deeply into it, so I'm working on that, and I'm working on a couple of screenplays as well, so yeah.
Russell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you very much.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of A Permanent Member of the Family, performed by Danny Campbell, Andrus Nichols, and Robin Miles.
Vivian sets Connie's platter of food and coffee in front of him. That gonna be it, Conrad? Please, Viv, for Christ's sake, don't call me Conrad. Only my ex-wife called me Conrad. And thankfully, I haven't heard it from her in nearly 30 years. I'm kidding, she says without looking at him. Connie, she adds. She takes Jack's order, oatmeal with milk and a cup of coffee, and heads back to the kitchen. For a few seconds, while his father digs into his breakfast, Jack studies the man. Jack's been a state trooper for 12 years, and studies people's behavior, even his 70-year-old father's, with a learned, calm detachment. You seem sort of agitated this morning, Dad. Everything okay? Yeah, sure. I was just teasing Viv about that Conrad business. But it is true, you know. Only your mother called me that. She used it to give me orders or criticize me. Like she was afraid I'd take advantage of her somehow if she got friendly enough to call me Connie. You probably would have. Yeah, well, your mother took off before I really had a chance to take advantage of her. Smart gal. She quit before I could fire her. That's one way to look at it. You have to let it go, Jack. She didn't want the job, and I did. In the end, everybody, including you boys, got what they needed. You're right, Dad, you're right. They've had this exchange 100 times. Vivian sets Jack's coffee and oatmeal in front of him and scoots away as if a little scared of Connie mocking him. Jack smiles agreeably after her and shakes out the front section of the newspaper and scans the headlines while he eats. Connie goes back to the sports page. Jack says, "Looks like we got through March without another bank robbery. Maybe our boy is headed south, like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid." He flips the front page over and goes on to national news. After a few minutes without looking up, Connie says, "You talked to Buzz and Chip recently?" Jack looks over at his father as if expecting more, then says, "No, not in the last few days." "Everything the same with them these days?" "More or less, far as I know." "Wives and kids?" "Yep, the same, far as I know. All is well." "No news is good news, Dad." "I wouldn't mind any kind of news, actually." "They're busy, Dad. It's easier for me. I don't have a wife and kids. Plus, Buzz has that long drive every day up to Dannemora and back. And Chip's taking criminal justice courses nights at North County Community College down in Ticonderoga. And they both live way the hell over in Keysville." "Don't take it personally, Dad." "I don't," Connie says, and goes back to reading the sports page. Jack finishes his oatmeal, shoves his bowl to one side, and cups his mug of coffee in his large red hands, warming them. He's thinking. He suddenly asks, "You ever consider it a little weird that all three of us went into law enforcement? I sometimes wonder about it. I mean, it isn't like you were a police officer, like me and Chip, or a prison guard like Buzz. I mean, you ran auctions." "Yeah, but don't forget, I'm a former Marine. And you're never an ex-Marine, Jack. So that was the standard you boys were raised by, the United States Marine Corps standard, especially after your mother took off."
We've just heard "A Permanent Member of the Family" by Russell Banks. Blending literature and memoir, Ann Patchett examines her deepest commitments to writing, family, friends, dogs, books, and her husband in This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. Stretching from her childhood to the present day, from a disastrous early marriage to a later happy one, the stories cover a multitude of topics, including charting the hard work and joy of writing and the unexpected thrill of opening a bookstore. As she shares stories of the people, places, ideals, and art to which she has remained indelibly committed, Anne, who narrates, brings into focus the large experiences and small moments that have shaped her as a daughter, wife, and writer.
The tricky thing about being a writer, or about being any kind of artist, is that in addition to making art, you also have to make a living. My short stories and novels have always filled my life with meaning, but, at least in the first decade of my career, they were no more capable of supporting me than my dog was. But part of what I love about both novels and dogs is that they are so beautifully oblivious to economic concerns. We serve them, and in return, they thrive. It isn't their responsibility to figure out where the rent is coming from. What I was looking for in a job was simple enough, something that would allow me to pay the bills and still leave me time to write. At first, I thought the key would be to put the burden on my back rather than my brain, and so I worked as a restaurant cook and later as a waitress. And I was right. There was plenty of room in my head for stories, but because I fell asleep the minute I stopped moving, very few of those stories were ever written down. Once I realized that physical labor wasn't the answer, I switched to teaching, the universally suggested career for all MFA graduates. And while I wasn't so tired, days spent attending to the creativity of others often left me uninterested in any sort of creativity of my own. Food service and teaching were the only two paying jobs I thought I was qualified for. And once I discovered that neither of them met my requirements, I was at a loss. Could I follow the example of Wallace Stevens and sell insurance? All I knew for certain was that I had to figure out how to both eat and write. The answer, at least the first spark of it, came in the form of a 250-word book review of Amy Tan's novel The Joy Luck Club. I had published several short stories in 17 magazine and had asked my editor, Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, both of us 25 at the time, if I could have a nonfiction assignment as well. The economics were easy enough to figure out. 17 ran one short story a month, 12 stories a year, and if I was doing my absolute best, I could never hope for more than one or two of those spots. A writer of nonfiction, on the other hand, could publish an article in every issue, sometimes multiple articles in a single issue. I had finally identified a job that I more or less knew how to do that would be neither mentally nor physically exhausting. Which is not to say that it wasn't aggravating at times. I was asked to rewrite that book review half a dozen times, and each time I was told I had to consider yet another aspect of the novel. My word count was not increased to match these new points of interest, and more words in meant that somewhere other words had to come out. So I trimmed and tucked, found a single word to express 5 words worth of feeling. I explored the realm of mother-daughter relationships on the head of a pin. Once my book review was accepted, I started pitching ideas for articles to Adrienne, who took the better ones to her boss, Robbie Myers. Unlike in my fiction, where I prided myself on making things up, I found these articles wanted personal experience. For every 10 story ideas I came up with, growing up with horses, or when your best friend's a guy, or how to decorate your locker, I would be given the green light to write one of them, without contract or kill fee. And for every 10 I was allowed to write, maybe one would actually make its way into the magazine. The one that was accepted would then be rewritten 10 times as I received round after round of notes, not only from Adrienne and Robbie, but from various editors in other departments and all their interns who were honing their own editorial skills. I never felt that way when I was 15, read the note most regularly penciled in the margins. And while I wanted to say, "Did you grow up in Tennessee? Did you go to a Catholic girls' school? Did you stay home with your parents on weekends and never go on a single date?" I refrained. If they wanted to see themselves reflected in my piece, I would put them there. I would find a way to wedge in every single one of them and stay within the confines of my word count.
That was This is the Story of a Happy Marriage by Ann Patchett. Small Victories, Spotting Improbable Moments of Grace, is Anne Lamott's long-awaited collection of new and selected stories and essays on hope, joy, and grace. Anne writes about faith, family, and community in ways that are both wise and irreverent. Our victories over hardship may seem small, but they change us, our perceptions, our perspectives, and our lives. Lamott, who performs her work, clarifies how we find the joy in getting lost and our amazement in finally being found.
The three of us had lunch in town 2 months earlier, before the feeding tube, before Kate. Barbara used the walker, which looked like a tall, compact shopping cart, but moved at a normal pace. She still ate with a fork, not a feeding tube, and spoke, although so softly that sometimes I had to turn to Susie for translation. Barbara talked about her wellness blog, her need for supplemental nutrition. Breath, nutrition, voice. Breath, nutrition, voice. She posted a list on her blog from time to time of all the things she could still do. Most recently, enjoy the hummingbirds, sleep with my sweetie, speak out for people with breast cancer. Now she is silent. When she wants to talk, she can type words on her iPad that Kate will then speak with efficient warmth. Or she can rest in silence. She knows that even this diminished function and due ability will be taken one day at a time. When you are on the knife's edge, when nobody knows exactly what is going to happen next, only that it will be worse, you take in today. So here we were at the trailhead for a cold day's walk. I'm a fast walker because my dad had long legs and I learned to keep up. But today a walk with Barbara was like, Mother, may I? May I take 1,000 baby steps? Barbara seemed by her look of concentration to align herself with all the particles here in the looming woods so that she could be as present and equal as possible. She couldn't bother with saying anything unimportant because she had to type it first. This relieved all of us from making crazy chatter. This is a musical grove. The redwoods are like organ pipes playing silent chords. Susie pointed out birds she knew and moved a few obstacles on our route as Barbara rolled on. Susie is the ultimate support, a weight-bearing wall. She's not, I am doing wondrous things, but simply helping both herself and Barbara be comfortable in the duo of them. She has lots of sly humor, but no gossipy edge except in a pinch. I have been to Muir Woods hundreds of times in my life, from my earliest days. This was where my family brought visitors. I got lost here at 4 amid the crowds, but it was different 50 years ago. For the parents, a missing child was scary, yet you did not assume the child was dead. I was always afraid, lost or not. I got lost so often, once for more than half an hour among 16,000 people at the Grand National Rodeo, that until I was 7, I had notes pinned to my coats, little cards of introduction, with my name and phone number. If found, please return, as if I were a briefcase. I have gotten lost all my life, maybe more than most, and been found every time. Even though I believe that the soul is immortal and grace bats last, I'm afraid because Barbara is going to die and Susie will be all alone. I love Wendell Berry's lines that it may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work, and that when we no longer know which way to go, we have begun our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. I have a lot of faith and a lot of fear a lot of the time. The day was so cold that for once Muir Woods did not smell of much. Heat brings out stronger smells, but today was crisply delicious. We walked along the path like kids moving as slowly as one humanly can. We rounded the first curve. Vroom! Susie and I spoke of nothing in particular. Barbara pointed to her ear and we stopped to listen to the tinkle of the creek and all the voices of the water. There was the interplay of birdsong and people song and the creek's conversation, as if it had a tongue, saying, keep going, we'll all just keep on going. You can't stop me or anything else anyway. Every sound is by definition a stop, which is how we can hear it. We were walking in step with Barbara as she held on to her conveyance, and I felt myself take on all the qualities that Barbara brought to the day, a fraught joy and awareness.
That was the sampling of Small Victories by Anne Lamott. We Live in Water is the first collection of short fiction from Jess Walters, author of the wildly popular Beautiful Ruins. This enjoyable collection has earned the distinction of being named a 2014 Audi Award finalist by the Audio Publishers Association. In Thief, a blue-collar worker turns unlikely detective to find out which of his kids is stealing from the family vacation fund. In We Live in Water, a lawyer returns to a corrupt North Idaho town to find his father, who disappeared 30 years earlier. In Anything Helps, a homeless man has to go to cardboard to raise enough money to buy his son the new Harry Potter book. And the collection's final story transforms a portrait of Walter's hometown into a moving contemplation of our times. Eduardo Ballerini narrates.
Bit sits against his pole. A slick creeps down his back. Then a guy in a gold convertible Mercedes almost makes the light, but has to slam on his brakes. I think you could have made it, Bit says. The guy looks him over. Says, you look healthy enough to work. Thanks, so do you. Let me guess, veteran? Yep, War of 1812. The guy laughs. Then what, you lost your house? Misplaced it. You're a funny... Hey, tell you what, I'll give you $20 if you tell me what you're gonna buy with it. The light changes, but the guy just sits there. A car goes around. Bit shields his eyes from the sun. You give me $20? Yeah, but you can't me. If I give you a 20, honestly, what are you gonna get? The new Harry Potter book. You are one funny... Thanks, you too. No, tell me exactly what you're gonna drink or smoke or whatever, and I'll give you 20. But it's gotta be the truth. The truth. Why does everyone always want that? He looks at the guy in his gold convertible. Back at the Jesus beds, they'd be gathering for group about now, trying to talk one another out of this very thing, this reverie, truth. Vodka, Bit says, because it f***s you up fastest. I'll get it at the store over on 2nd, whatever cheap stuff they got, plastic in case I drop it, and I'll get a bag of nuts or pretzels. Whatever money's left, Bit's mouth is dry, I'll put in municipal bonds. After the guy drives off, Bit looks down at the $20 bill in his hand. Maybe he is a funny f***. Bit slides the book forward. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. What's a hallow, anyway? He asks. The clerk takes the book and runs it through the scanner. I guess it's British for hollow. I don't read those books. I read the first one. It was pretty good. Bit looks around Auntie's bookstore, big and open, a few soft chairs between the rows of books. So what do you read? Polanyuk. That'll be $28.56. Bit whistles. Counts out the money and sets it on the counter. 70 cents short. The clerk has those big loopy earrings that stretch out your lobes. He moves his mouth as he counts the money. How big are you gonna make those holes in your ears? Maybe like quarter size? Hey, you're a little short. You got a discount card? Bit pats himself down. In my other pants. Be right back, the kid says, and leaves with the book. I'm kind of in a hurry, Bit says to the kid's back. He needs to stop by the Jesus beds, although he knows Cater might not let him in. He likes Cater, in spite of the guy's mean Jesus rules and intense mean Jesus eyes. It's a shame what happened, because Bit had been doing so good, going to group almost every day, working dinner shifts and in the yard. Cater has this pay system at the Jesus beds, where you serve or clean or do yard work and get paid in these vouchers that you redeem for snacks and shit at the little store they run. Keeps everything kind of in-house and gets people used to spending their money on something other than getting f***ed up. Of course, there's a side market in the vouchers, dime on the dollar. So over time, people save enough to get stewed. But Bit's been keeping that under control too, almost like a civilian. No crank for more than a year. Just a beer or two once a month, occasionally a split bottle of wine. Then last weekend happened. At group on Thursday, Fat Danny had been bragging again about the time he OD'd, and that made Bit think of Julie, the way her foot kept twitching after she stopped breathing. So after group, he took a couple of bucks from his stash, the hollow rail of his bed, and had a beer. In a tavern. Like a real person. Leaned up against the bar, watching baseball. And it was great. They didn't even drink all of it. It was more about the bar than the beer. but it tasted so good. He broke down on Friday and got 2 40s at the quick stop.
That was We Live in Water by Jess Walter. From the publication of his first Booker-nominated novel at age 26, John McGregor's fiction has been defined by poetic language, a keen sense of detail, and insightful characterization. Now, after publishing 3 novels, McGregor turns his talent towards short fiction in This Isn't the Sort of Thing That Happens to Someone Like You. Set among the lowlands and levees of eastern England, the stories expose lives where much is buried and much is at risk. Tender moments are often hard won. These tales are an intricate exploration of isolation, self-discovery, and the impact of place. Piers Gibbon performs the collection.
She stood by the window and said, "Those trees are turning that beautiful color again." "Is that right?" I asked. I was at the back of the house in the kitchen. I was doing the dishes. The water wasn't hot enough. She said, "I don't know what color you'd call it." These were the trees on the other side of the road she was talking about, across the junction. It's a wonder they do so well where they are with the traffic. I don't know what they are, some kind of maple or sycamore, perhaps. This happens every year, and she always seems taken by surprise. These years get shorter every year. She said, "I could look at them all day. I really could." I rested my hands in the water, and I listened to her standing there, her breathing. She didn't say anything. She kept standing there. I emptied the bowl and refilled it with hot water. The room was cold, and the steam poured out of the water and off the dishes. I could feel it on my face. She said, "They're not just red. That's not it, is it now?" I rinsed off the frying pan and ran my fingers around it to check for grease. My knuckles were starting to ache again already. She said, "When you close your eyes on a sunny day, it's a bit like that color."
That was a sampling of This Isn't the Sort of Thing That Happens to Someone Like You by John McGregor. Phil Clay's Redeployment takes listeners to the front lines of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, asking us to understand what happened there and what happened to the soldiers who returned. Interwoven with themes of brutality and faith, guilt and fear, helplessness and survival, the characters in these stories struggle to make meaning out of chaos. In Redeployment, a soldier must learn what it's like to return to domestic life in suburbia, surrounded by people who have no idea where Fallujah is. In After Action Report, a lance corporal seeks expiation for a killing he did not commit. And in the darkly comic Money as a Weapon System, a young Foreign Service officer is given the absurd task of helping Iraqis improve their lives by teaching them to play baseball. Craig Klein performs the stories that reveal the intricate combination of monotony, bureaucracy, comradeship, and violence that make up a soldier's daily life at war, and the isolation and despair that can accompany a soldier's homecoming.
But here's the thing. I'm thinking a lot, and I mean a lot, about those dogs. And I'm thinking about my dog, Vicar. About the shelter we'd got him from, where Cheryl said we'd had to get an older dog because nobody takes older dogs. How we could never teach him anything. How he'd throw up shit he shouldn't have eaten in the first place. How he'd slink away all guilty, tail down and head low and back legs crouched. How his fur started turning gray 2 years after we got him. He had so many white hairs on his face that it looked like a mustache. So there it was. Vicar and Operation Scooby. All the way home. Maybe, I don't know, you're prepared to kill people. You practice on man-shaped targets, so you're ready. Of course, we got targets they called dog targets. Target-shaped delta. But they don't look like dogs. And it's not easy to kill people, either. Out of boot camp, Marines act like they're gonna play Rambo, but it's serious, it's professional. Usually. We found this one insurgent doing the death rattle, foaming and shaking. Up, you know? He's hit with a 7.62 in the chest and pelvic girdle. He'll be gone in a second, but the company XO walks up, pulls out his K-bar, and slits his throat. Says, it's good to kill a man with a knife. All the Marines look at each other like, what the f***? Didn't expect that from the XO. That's some PFC. On the flight, I thought about that too. It's so funny. You're sitting there with your rifle in your hands, but no ammo in sight. And then you touch down in Ireland to refuel, and it's so foggy you can't see, but, you know, this is Ireland. It's gotta be beer. And the plane's captain, a civilian, reads off some message about how general orders stay in effect until you reach the States, and you're still considered on duty. So, no alcohol. Well, our CO jumped up and said, that makes about as much sense as a football bat. All right, Marines, you got 3 hours. I hear they serve Guinness. Ooh, f***ing rah. Corporal Weissert ordered 5 beers at once and had them laid out in front of him. He didn't even drink for a while, just sat there looking at them all happy. O'Leary said, look at you, smiling like a f***, which is a DI expression Curtis loves. So Curtis laughs and says, what a horrible f***ing tree. And we all start cracking up, happy just knowing we can get f***ed up, let our guard down. We got crazy quick. Most of us had lost about 20 pounds, and it had been 7 months since we'd had a drop of alcohol. McManigan, second award PFC, was rolling around the bar with his n***s hanging out of his camis, telling Marines, stop looking at my b-. Lance Corporal Slaughter was there all of a half hour before he puked in the bathroom, with Corporal Craig, the sober Mormon, helping him out, and Lance Corporal Greeley, the drunk Mormon, puking in the stall next to him. Even the company guns got wrecked. It was good. We got back on the plane and passed the f*** out. Woke up in America. Except when we touched down in Cherry Point, there was nobody there. It was zero dark and cold, and half of us were rocking the first hangover we'd had in months, which at that point was a kind of f***ing that felt pretty f***ing good. And we got off the plane, and there's a big empty landing strip, maybe a half dozen red patchers and a bunch of 7-tons lined up. No families. The company guns said they were waiting for us at Lejeune. The sooner we get the gear loaded on the trucks, the sooner we see them. Roger that. We set up working parties, tossed our rucks and sea bags into the 7-tons. Heavy work, and it got the blood flowing in the cold. Sweat a little of the alcohol out, too. Then they pulled up a bunch of buses, and we all got on, packed in, M16 sticking everywhere, muzzle awareness gone to but it didn't matter. Cherry Point to Lejeune's an hour. First bits through trees. You don't see much in the dark. Not much when you get on 24 either. Stores that haven't opened yet. Neon lights off at the gas stations and bars. Looking out, I sort of knew where I was, but I didn't feel home. I figured I'd be home when I kissed my wife and pet my dog.
We've just heard Redeployment by Phil Clay. Honeydew is the new story collection from Edith Perlman, winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award and finalist for the National Book Award. Perlman writes about the predicaments of being human. Her stories shine light on small, precise moments to reflect the beauty and grace found in everyday life. Perlman maps the psychological landscapes of her characters with unending compassion and seeming effortlessness. Suzanne Torin narrates.
He liked to see the customers relax on the chair, as if this quasi-biblical experience transported them to some soapy heaven. As if, briefly dead, they could call their sins forgiven. Or maybe they were just happy to have a chance to kick off their shoes and talk about their troubles. He conducted his classes, showed his slides, met with students during his office hours. He found the teaching and the kids distracting. One of the blonde young women reminded him of Renee, knowledgeable on the outside, unsure on the inside. But even inviting a student to take in a movie was forbidden. And so he hurried away from his office hours to watch, alone, the blameless performance on Main Street. The days got shorter. Page's last customers walked under dim streetlights and entered a brightly lit shop. One dark afternoon, Bobby saw the red-cheeked chemistry professor and his wife side by side on the chairs as if driving to the movies. Paige, gently kicking her stool, moved from one to the other. Down in his study, Bobby took off his own shoes and then his right sock. He had stopped attending to his feet after the accident. Now, how appalling the linty, corned toes. How distressing the jagged toenails. No wonder all his socks had holes. He took off his left sock and rested the left foot on his right knee. His heel was scored with lines, as if it could reveal his fortune. Still barefoot, he returned to his unlit turret and looked out of the window. Bent over the chemistry professor's tootsies, Paige personified hard work, like Renee bent over her briefs. Back in New York, Renee had moved inflexibly toward her goal. She wanted to be made partner, whereas Bobby had practiced indifference and inattention, writing careless reviews for short-lived arts magazines, making off-the-cuff attributions for the galleries he consulted for. This difference in attitude had led to arguments. After her last customer left, Paige often came out and sat on the store's single broad step and lit a narrow cigar. Bobby used the toilet, reading by flashlight. He turned off the flashlight and watched her smoke. Around midnight, she went to bed. He did too. This went on for a while. He thought of buying binoculars, but she wasn't a bird. He thought of dragging out his opera glasses, but she wasn't a soprano. He thought of employing his loop, but she wasn't a work of art. And even if she had been a painting, he was too far away to examine brush strokes. After the first snowfall, she wore a parka outdoors and a fuzzy hat. She needed a fur coat, otter maybe like Renee's, but the animal rights students would put her in the stocks. Anyway, she probably couldn't afford a fur coat. How much did you collect for a dead marine? And even a flourishing pedicure business couldn't make a big profit. She could always go to work in the local pharmacy, he supposed. She'd studied pharmacy, she told him once, but she preferred this work. She was her own boss, and she ministered directly to people. Spring at last moistened the town. Impasto leaves replaced pastel buds. He considered self-improvement. He might become a vegan. Let the mouse have his cheese. "So, how much does it cost?" he blurted one afternoon. They'd met in the health store, he holding a jar of prune extract plucked in a hurry from the shelf, she examining something in a bottle. "This is $1 an ounce, but for efficacy it has to be mixed with not the snake oil. A pedicure."
That was Honeydew by Edith Perlman. Readers, these stories have opened my eyes to the mastery of writers who make every word count. Whatever your favorite genre, find new suggestions on my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.